You're listening to Your Pod and Your Staff, the podcast of College Life Christian Fellowship at UC Davis. I am Peter Nittler, the college pastor of First Baptist Church in Davis, California, and our mission is to shape college-age people from all spiritual starting points into complete and equipped agents of King Jesus. And on this podcast, we want to have conversations that will accompany our Tuesday night Zoom gatherings, and we hope that they form you, encourage you, maybe even make you laugh, and that they would be a source of King Jesus guiding you through this time. And on today's episode, my podcast pal, Stanford Gibson, sits in the question asker role to see what was going through my mind as I read through 1 Timothy. And I realized something after Stanford and I hung up on the call, and it's this, that I understand and love this letter, 1 Timothy, more after talking about it with him than how I did before. And that might seem entirely obvious and unremarkable, but sometimes you just need to say the obvious thing. And so here it is. You know, I think that the unfortunate illusion of things like sermons or podcasts is that because you're listening to a finished product, the listeners are tricked into thinking that the speakers are somehow on a different level, that they understand and love the text more than the listener can ever hope to. And I know this is wrong because for me, my process of knowing and loving a text always and without exception features a conversation like the one you're about to hear. Two or more people who really want to know the text and to love the text sit down and just talk about it, with the freedom to go down rabbit trails, to ask questions, to wonder aloud together. And so I want to say, if you find yourself continually confused or uninspired by the text, maybe you, like me, need to find a conversation buddy. That doesn't make you needy. That doesn't make you weak. That makes you a Christian. And I guess the reason I'm bringing this up now is that this episode, more than the rest of them, felt like a good example of that process for me. You know, I'm digesting 1 Timothy not by bringing answers to the table, but by introducing topics and questions that we didn't necessarily have the answers for, but we sort of discovered a direction as we talked. And so we just do a lot of wondering together. I wonder what Paul meant when he talks about bad teaching. I wonder what Paul meant when he uses the word conscience. Or I wonder what Paul meant when he talks about how the church ought to be perceived by the watching world. So we do a lot of wondering, and it was awesome. And so I hope, again, that this is as much fun to listen to as it was to talk about. And I hope that you enjoy the pod. All right, Stanford Gibson, we are back on Your Pod and Your Staff. Hello, good morning to you.
Good morning, Peter.
It's good to see you, as always, and I have a hot take for you. I actually don't think it's hot. I think it's lukewarm. But do you think that most people think they wish they were reading the Bible more?
I think that most people think they wish they were reading the Bible more. I think most people of faith.
Yeah.
You know, most general people probably aren't sitting around thinking, man, I wish I read the Bible more. But
yeah.
I think most people who are committed to the validity and value of the text are. Yeah.
Yeah. So there's a myriad of different reasons why people then wouldn't be reading the Bible more. Because you can think, okay, if it's good to read it and if you want to read it more, then you should just read it more. And I don't know what you hear from people, but I often hear things like it's boring. It is hard to understand. It feels opaque to me. They probably don't use that word, but hard to understand, confusing. And I think I've come to a conclusion that we can take something off the board.
Oh, yeah.
Of a reason. Yeah.
What do you want to take off the board?
We must take boring
I think
off the board.
Boring has to come off the board.
We must. We must. If you think it's boring, it's because you really haven't read it for a long time. It's unbelievably not boring.
It had been a couple of years since I'd read 1 Timothy because we're on this cycle where we're teaching the Bible in 4 years. And 1 Timothy's not boring.
Yeah. Before Kyle Jung told me how to order at boba places, my big critique was that there was just too much on the menu.
I'm going to need the Kyle Jung tutorial because that's where I am with boba places.
Right. So I feel the same thing. It's like, okay, yeah, there's a lot of reasons why someone would find the reading of the Bible a teensy bit unpleasant. Mm-hmm. But I think it's time to simplify the menu a little bit and say we're taking boring off the listing. We can't do it anymore. There's too much that is compelling, interesting,
offensive.
Offensive things.
Yeah,
it's like,
that's right.
What? Or just like confusing word choices. And it's just like, if you want it to be interesting, it will reward you.
And yeah,
it won't always be, again, easy or simple or exactly what you want it to say, but it is not boring. And so we need to take that off the menu.
Yeah.
I'll have another hot take for you, by the way, at my quarantine corner. So just get ready for that.
Okay, that's good.
Yeah. I bet I was workshopping it.
Yeah. I have a couple hot takes for you during the course of the text. So okay. It'll be one of those.
Good. Yeah. Hot take city. So anyway, we are in 1 Timothy, and you know, this is a little bit of a different letter. We have, for the most part, been reading letters that either James or Paul have been writing to churches, and so like to a group of people meant to be digested by a group of people. And now we're taking a little bit of a turn into this letter. I think Timothy is probably the only one that we're reading that is the
Yeah, this is the only personal correspondence.
Yeah, so it's really written to a person, which changes it a little bit. This is also another chance to see that it's weird that this is male.
Yeah, but that's right.
Because if I'm writing you a letter, you know, say I moved to, I don't know, Norwegia.
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 I think it's Norway.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like the impulse of like the cheesy Christmas movies where they like make up a kingdom for there to be a prince.
Oh, that's
or a princess.
That's right.
So anyway, I moved to Norwegia and I write you a letter and I reference, you know, this conversation.
Yes.
And I'm probably not going to tell the whole story of this conversation.
Right.
I'm going to say the word Norwegia or something like that.
Right.
It's going to bring us back.
It'll be an inside joke.
Yeah.
And it's one side of the conversation.
Right. And so Paul keeps hinting at throughout both 1 Timothy and 2 Timothy that they have had this connection. So if we back up, it seems like Acts 16 tells us that Paul met Timothy in Lystra. And it's interesting, actually, Timothy was the son of a Jewish woman and a Greek man, which is kind of fun. You know, it's sort of like he's a little bit of these two strands of the story coming together.
It reminded me of what Rafik talks about, you know, a liminal existence of having these two very distinct identities. They're bumping up against each other.
Right. And interesting, I seem to have forgotten this detail that Timothy goes with Paul to like sort of be a missionary to these churches. And before they go, Paul circumcises Timothy.
I noticed that as well. Welcome to the mission.
I got to tell you, I'm unprepared to speak any more about that.
I have to say as well, but especially given Paul's whole thing about, hey, you know what? You don't need to be circumcised. Like, let's not make this something you need to do to get in.
Right.
And then this happens. It definitely was right there.
Well, it's interesting. It might come to play even further in our conversation.
I think
where, you know, Paul has really strong thoughts about how the world ought to work. You don't actually need to be circumcised, but he also is pragmatic about like, hey, you're not going to be taken seriously, at least at this point in the story.
Right.
If you're not circumcised. Right. So if you're serious about this, let's get this done. You know?
Yep.
Yeah.
That's a pretty serious, like, pastoral interview.
Yeah. So anyway, so then we hear in this letter from Paul to Timothy, Paul talk about this moment that they had where Paul seemed to lay hands on Timothy, maybe with other people involved, and pray for him. And essentially like, give him these like gifts, like bless him with gifts of teaching and passions. And Paul is essentially continuing to encourage Timothy to like live into that reality and live into that being true. But it's just funny because that seems like a really important moment in their relationship, but he's not telling that story. And so it's like we might want to know, hey, if this is so important, we should know this story. You know, we as like these readers further down the road. But again, it's like, this is mail. This was not written to be a treatise for us to know how to bless someone with gifts or something like that, how to pray for someone like that. It just happened and it's part of their relationship. So anyway, if you remember, Timothy was the guy that Paul sent to Philippi, and he was the one who Paul said, I really have no one like Timothy. You know, all the other people on my team there, they might be great, but Timothy's sort of the star. And so I'm sending him to you. And the occasion for writing this particular letter is that he's sending him to Ephesus. And just a little reminder is that Paul was actually in Ephesus for like 3.5 years. And he was doing his normal thing. He was talking in the synagogues, talking out in the open, telling people that Jesus is king and that this matters for the world and that this story has come to fruition. He's not just the king of the Jewish people. He's actually the king of the whole world and, you know, probably making tents and everything. And what happened was this story really clashed with the story that the Ephesians were living, which was that, you know, Artemis was the great god in Ephesus, this massive building dedicated to the temple, the Artemisian. And so much of the economy was built on Artemis worship. And so now if Paul comes in telling the story that actually Artemis is nothing, that Jesus is king, then that whole economy, if that message catches on, that whole economy is uprooted. And so people are not going to respond kindly to that. And so when some people who have made their living selling little Artemis bobblehead figurines, if enough of those people get upset, then you can imagine there could be a riot, which obviously this is what happens in Ephesus, is that there's this massive riot and people are just shouting, great is Artemis of the Ephesians, great is Artemis of the Ephesians. And so Paul eventually gets expelled from Ephesus.
Peter, do you think it would be fair to say that like 1 Timothy could also be titled 2 Ephesians?
I was actually thinking the same thing. Because in my notes, I kept talking about like the Ephesians, the Ephesians, the Ephesians. And I kept having to remind myself, actually, this isn't written to the Ephesians. This is written to Timothy on the benefit of for the Ephesians. It's sort of like on the mail when, what do you do, like C/O?
Yeah, care of.
Yeah, care. Yeah. Yeah. That's sort of what it is. It's to Timothy, but it's for the Ephesians.
Yeah.
But yeah. And so from what I remember about Ephesus, obviously it was the Christian movement was not very big before Paul got there. And then it made a big enough dent into the culture that it actually became a formidable sort of church region. And
that's
so
right.
The occasion for Paul writing this to Timothy, sending Timothy to Ephesus, is that something's going on that is not kosher. Sorry, that's maybe not the best best word choice. Something's going on that's not benefiting the churches. The churches are in a little bit of trouble. Mm-hmm. Because it seems like mostly there are these people coming in town and they are teaching these sort of wonky ideas. And Paul talks about it right in the beginning where he says, as I urged you when I was going to Macedonia, remain at Ephesus so that you may charge certain persons not to teach any different doctrine, nor to devote themselves to myths and endless genealogies, which promote speculations rather than stewardship. And so there's these people who seem like they are really interested in interested in the scriptures, but in a way that, which I think we're going to try and tease out of sort of what exactly is the issue, but that people are teaching things that are sort of leading people down the wrong path, to put it really, really generally.
Right. Well, I think that's a good transition because, Peter, you were the one who really dove into this letter, mm-hmm. and you're the one who will be teaching it. And so we're going to do our best. I'm going to do my very best Peter impression here to actually try to draw some of that out of you. And
yeah.
So I'm going to actually walk us through the categories today. And I think that that's really connected to our first category. The category we usually hit mm-hmm. at the beginning is the one that we usually sing. And I'm going to skip that this time.
Yeah.
The first category is I themed a theme. And so, Peter, what was one of the big themes that emerged as you read this book?
Don't you mean what was one of the big themes that I themed?
I'm sorry. Yeah. What was one of the big themes that you themed? I forgot we were using that as a verb. A lot of grammar on this podcast.
Yeah. I think the main theme, if you're reading through specifically 1 Timothy, you kind of can't miss it. You know, there's some very poignant things that happen in between these sections, you know, which we'll talk about. But this idea and this concern about bad teaching, false teaching, rotten mm-hmm. teaching is what I, for some reason, I keep saying. It's like, it's just this rotten teaching, this teaching that's going on that is swaying the people in the churches to bad scenarios. And he uses phrases like shipwrecking their faith. He uses phrases like swerved from the faith. You know, it's like this is taking them away from center, like away from the sort of life-saving vein of the truth of Jesus. There's something going on here that is rotten. It's sort of spoiling the good seed that he had planted when he was in Ephesus. And it shows up in the beginning in chapter 1. We'll talk about some of those features. And it comes up again in chapter 4 and then at the end in chapter 6. So it's sort of all the way throughout. You kind of see these hints of what Paul is hoping Timothy goes in and addresses or fixes. And what I would love to do is sort of just like call out something and then try to trace out what is the teaching that Paul seems to be so against and what is the good teaching that he's hoping that they do. So we can maybe address kind of the main concern that I have as I'm reading this. And the main concern that I have, to be honest, when I'm reading this section is because there's not actually a ton about what the content is of the bad teaching, I guess I just have this fear and I'm curious to know what you think. What's stopping anyone at any time from saying that anyone that they disagree with falls into the category that Paul is trying to denounce? And it just feels like these verses can be used as a weapon to justify your own teaching mm-hmm. over and against someone else's teaching. So even if you think a lot of people are saying right now that you can't be a Christian if you voted for Donald Trump, or you can't be a Christian if you voted for Joe Biden because of the abortion mm-hmm. issue, you know,
right,
and
right.
you know, you might think, oh yeah, those the people on the other side, they are just dealing with, you know, this theology that causes slander and strife and quarreling.
Right.
And we're the ones really seeing the truth. You know, either side can say that. Or, you know, a couple weeks ago, I delineated, hopefully usefully, this sort of new perspective on Paul. And I can imagine because it has the word new perspective in it, someone could say, oh, you are dealing with these myths and endless genealogies. You know, you're trying to find right. something new in the text. You're sort of just trying to tinker with it. So it says something really interesting and you're trying to solve the puzzle. And mm-hmm. as opposed to just seeing exactly what it says on its face. And I could see someone sort of saying that to me. And it just feels like because there's not a lot of doctrinal statements attached to the good teaching versus the bad teaching, it feels like it can be used as a weapon to sort of shut down anyone that you disagree with. And that feels very scary to me.
I think that you're absolutely right. That was the major theme that jumped out to me in a way that hadn't before.
Yeah.
Is that almost everything that Paul is saying in this letter is woven through with this theme of, he calls it speculations, yeah. vain discussions, confident assertions without understanding.
Yeah.
Controversies, things that develop friction, and silly myths,
right.
and things that emerge from depraved minds. I mean, he went to the thesaurus on this right. one, right? Like, he's not messing around. And like, it definitely is a major theme. But like, I guess what I'm hearing you say is that, okay, that's fine, because we believe that, you know, Paul was inspired by the Holy Spirit, and like, we believe that he was probably right in this situation, mm-hmm. right? But how can we apply that, not being in the same Holy Spirit inspired position? And, you know, is this just, you know, a way to kind of marginalize any voice that isn't ours?
Yeah, yeah. Or at least, can't we see that certainly this can be used for sort of power as opposed to actual faithful teaching, you know? And because yeah. like, you gave a little list of the words that Paul said about what makes bad teaching. And, you know, I made a list that has some overlap, but in chapter 1, verse 6, he calls it vain, which I think we can say is sort of useless, you know? It mm-hmm. promotes speculation rather than stewardship in 1:4. It leads to quarreling. That comes up a few times. So there's something about the effect that it has on the people that seems to matter. Like, he's not laying out the tenets of the teaching. He's laying out what happens to people when they listen to this teaching, which I think is very interesting. It has a tendency to, quote unquote, add to Jesus. Like, I think what Paul is wanting to just say over and over and over again is that, you know, even Bronwyn talked about it in the Colossians episode, like, Christ in us, the hope of glory. Like, that's the message. We don't want to add anything to that. That's why he keeps saying, you do not need to be circumcised. You know, you do not need to add these ethnic traits to yourself. You need to be in the Messiah, and the Messiah needs to be in you. And that's the message. You know, he died for you. He's the king of the world. And so we see in chapter 4 that Paul's saying, you know, there's people who keep talking about how marriage is bad and you can't eat certain foods. And he's like, that's just trash.
Right. It's just silly.
I went through three other words that I was like, I probably shouldn't say that word.
Yeah, right.
That is trash. Yeah. Because we don't want to add anything to Jesus. Like, Jesus is the way to be in this family. And so we see that part of the bad teaching that he's realizing in Ephesus is trying to add to Jesus. And then there's also a sense that we get in chapter 6 that it seems to be connected to money, that there's something about the teaching and the bad teaching that it leads to anger and quarreling and strife and division, that it's also people think that they can get money if they are teaching this way. And that just seems totally counterintuitive to the faith to try and get rich off of your teaching about Jesus, you know?
Well, so, I think there are a couple of clues. Mm-hmm. One is that when we covered Philippians and Colossians, I talked about how those had the clearest statements of who Jesus is in Paul's letters. But I actually forgot, there's a legitimate, like, no kidding statement of faith in 1 Timothy, mm-hmm. right? Where he, and this seems like it's a rule of faith that was part of the church from way before this letter. So it's like really ancient, really original. Mm-hmm. And so there is a sense in which he's saying there are these fundamental truths that we've always held about who Jesus is. If you depart from those, you know, basically what's happened is that the church now has an infrastructure for teaching. Mm-hmm. And, you know, some of the mystery teachers in the region said, oh, you know, if we can take over this infrastructure, we can spread our message much more quickly. And so Paul's saying, hey, watch out.
Yeah.
There's lots of people who are going to try to manipulate this institution we've built for their own gain. Make sure these ideas are at the center of it. But then the other thing that I think is really interesting is that you're right. He doesn't talk a lot about the content of the false teaching of the, what are you calling it?
Rotten
teaching. Yeah. But he's talking a lot about the effects of it. In chapter 1, he goes into this long list. And we've talked about these lists before of like all of the like moral failures that are possible. And this has got some really nasty ones in it. Like people who sell other people into slavery, mm-hmm. people who strike their mother and or father, yeah. like elder abuse is in here. And like he lists some practices. And then he says, or whatever else is contrary to sound doctrine. And the idea is that these teachings, the doctrines, they're not like premises or like things that you intellectually assert to. They're practices. They're parts of like how the community interacts.
Yeah. And you know, it's interesting, you know, because like I said, we're reading Ephesians for a conversation we're going to have with Dan, or that we had with Dan. There's a section where he's talking about sort of the logic of being part of one family. And he says something that's really intriguing. And I don't know if I know much about it yet. I haven't thought enough about it. But he says, be angry and do not sin. Mm-hmm. And it seems like he's saying on some level that there's this logic of when you are going to be in the family of God, because it's this multi-ethnic family now, and multicultural, multi-ethnic family, like you're gonna butt heads, like you're gonna run up against differences that might make you angry. So yeah, it's actually a sign of health sometimes when there's anger or when there's frustration, because it means that you're doing the necessary work of interacting together under the banner that now the only thing that really marks you is your faith in Jesus together. Mm-hmm. So when I read this stuff about in Timothy about, like, you know, don't be quarreling and stuff like that, I generally hear that as like, oh yeah, if there's any quarreling in the church, that's a bad thing, you know? But if you take what he earlier said to the Ephesians, right, it's like, I wonder if he would say, no, you're being angry and you're sinning, you know? I told you, be angry and do not sin, not be angry and sin. And I think maybe the fact that it's described as divisive, I think maybe that is one of the main elements of critique of this teaching, that it's actually breaking the family apart, as opposed to building this family together, you know?
Right. You and I have talked before about the best marriage advice I ever got. Yeah. And is a pastor, Jeff L., who told us that not all couples fight, and which I just thought was garbage. Yeah. Like, I just thought couples fight. That's what happens. And he said, no, you know, all couples disagree, but fighting includes the intent to harm.
Yeah.
And it moves from a passionate disagreement to a fight when there's the intent to harm. And I think that that's what you're seeing here, is that, like, all churches disagree, right? Like, all churches have difference. It's going to, you know, manifest as disagreement. And, like, the beautiful thing about the church is that it can metabolize that disagreement in redemptive ways. But what you're seeing here, people are actually trying to stir up dissent for financial gain.
Yeah.
I think it's because of power, right? There's a desire to shift the power of this institution to themselves. Mm-hmm. But it's also just, like, based on things that aren't central. And that's why in chapter 3, he gives us this rule of faith where he says, you know, Jesus was manifest in the flesh, vindicated by the Spirit, seen by angels, proclaimed among the nations, believed on the world, and taken up to glory. Saying, you know, this is what's fundamental.
Yeah.
And if there are arguments happening about these, like, marginal things, then someone's probably doing that to stir up trouble, either to, you know, get power or to, you know, just consolidate resources.
Yeah. Which leads me to something that falls under the "that reminds me" category. But before we do that, like, you know, we've been talking about the kind of teaching that it is, but I'd love to just read one section in chapter 6. The people who do this, he says, and verse 4, who teach in this way, have an unhealthy craving for controversy and for quarrels about words, which produce envy, dissension, slander, evil suspicions, and constant friction among people who are depraved in mind and deprived of the truth, imagining that godliness is a means of gain. And that's what we mean by the money thing. But part of me wants to offer an example, like sort of modern day example of this is what we mean. Like, this is an analog to what Paul's talked about with Timothy. But I feel like I'm so scared because I don't want to do the mistake of what I mentioned earlier of just saying, oh, yeah, the thing that I disagree with is
this other person.
But certainly this is still something to be aware of, you know, of when we are hearing teaching that it seems like the effect that it's having is that it's causing quarrels. And it seems to be, there's something about how Paul thinks that this is, it's like tedious teaching too. It's like tedious, like word study. Mm-hmm. And I, the thing that I think about that is, like, you know, say a pastor or someone who's teaching, like, makes much out of a small little word or verse that feels like it doesn't quite fit into the rest of the text, but sort of taken out of context, it seems like it's saying something. And then you build an entire theology on that verse.
Yeah,
like that feels like the thing that he's saying, do not do that. You know, you need to look at the scope of this story. Mm-hmm. Yes, we read and we parse and we study so that we can know the story better and more fully. But it's almost like the capital T truth of, like, the grand story of the scriptures is that which interprets individual components, you know? And so it's a little bit of a feedback.
Yeah, that's right.
But okay, so I want to get to that reminds me. So I'm taking back the reins, but you can have them back later. So one of the categories is that we think, okay, that reminds me of X, Y, or Z, where we're reading these texts and it's like, oh, that sort of sounds like this other section. And so I don't know what you thought, but in chapter 4, in the beginning of chapter 4, I'm going to read it. It's 5 verses, so sorry that's a little long. But he says, Paul says, now the Spirit expressly says that in later times, some will depart from the faith by devoting themselves to deceitful spirits and teachings of demons through the insincerity of liars whose consciences are seared, which is interesting. Who, then he says this, who forbid marriage and require abstinence from foods that God created to be received with thanksgiving by those who believe and know the truth. So he's saying that these bad teachers are saying, don't get married and don't eat these foods. And Paul's just like, come on, you know, for everything created by God is good and nothing is to be rejected if it is received with thanksgiving, for it is made holy by the word of God and prayer. So again, so it seems like the thesis of that section is, gosh, these people are teaching these things that they're saying, like, don't do this and don't do that, of things that God has called good. With the food laws, it's a little bit easier to see because the people of God have often had a relationship with food that they shouldn't eat one thing and shouldn't eat another thing. You know, that there's been boundaries around food. And it seems like what Paul is saying is like, not anymore. Like all these things have been created by God and they are good and they are to be enjoyed, particularly with thankfulness and gratitude for God. And it reminds me of this section in Romans 14 that I feel like comes up all the time when I'm, I don't know, in conversations with students, or it just comes up a lot. And in Romans 14, Paul is talking about those who are like weak in the faith, which I think means that those who are still sort of attached to the old way, you know, mm-hmm. who still are sort of like, yeah, I get that we don't have to be held by the food laws, but like, I kind of think we still do. You know, it's just hard to break themselves from the old way. So I think that those who are weak in the faith are supposed to be those people. And he's saying, yeah, as for the one who is weak in faith, welcome him or her, but not to quarrel over opinions. You know, one person believes he may eat anything, while the weak person eats only vegetables. Let not the one who eats, so like the one who eats anything, despise the one who abstains. And let not the one who abstains pass judgment on the one who eats, for God has welcomed him. And then if it keeps going, it says, one person esteems one day as better than another, while another esteems all days alike. And I think that's getting at the way that the Jewish calendar had, there was Sabbath laws, obviously, and there was also different feasts and festivals throughout the year, you know? So it's like there people behave differently on different days, you know? And he says, each one should be fully convinced in his own mind. Essentially, you should be, whatever way you live, you should be convinced in your own mind that it's the right way to live. And the one who observes the day observes it in honor of the Lord. The one who eats, eats in honor of the Lord, since he gives thanks to God, while the one who abstains, abstains in honor of the Lord and gives thanks to God. So now we're in the thick of Paul's strange sentences that it's hard to follow. But, you know, he says, for if we live to the Lord, and if we die, we die to the Lord. So then, whether we live or whether we die, we are the Lord's. So again, it feels like a similar idea in Romans and Timothy, that there are people who are telling you that these things are bad and you can't do them. And there might be good reason for that. It might, you know, it might be that like, hey, if, you know, if they're forbidding marriage, it might be because marriage hasn't worked out well for a lot of these people. Maybe there's been some unhealthy patterns in marriage. And what Paul is saying, it's not marriage isn't the problem. It's the hearts of the people. You know, like God created marriage and it's good. And it's not food that's the problem. It's maybe the arguments about food that are the problem. And, you know, it also, because of that, it sort of reminds me of both Psalm 51 and Micah 6:8, where, you know, in Psalm 51, the psalmist, David, is describing what God is saying. And it's like, I don't want your sacrifices. I want a broken and a contrite heart. Mm-hmm. That's what I want from you. You know, even though the laws are written that the sacrifices are to sort of appease me or whatever, like, I want your heart. Like, I want you to love me and to care for people. And in Micah 6:8, you know, in one of the famous passages, it's a similar thing. It's like, I don't want your 1,000, whatever, rivers of gold. I remember saying, I don't want all your sacrifices. What I want is for you, oh man, to act justly, love mercy, and walk humbly before your God. What I want is for you to know that I am God and to sort of accept my Godship and thank me for the things that you're eating. And the other stuff just comes second. You know, and a lot of people are going to put up rules and things to yes, do or not do. And those might be good ideas, but you should know that they're not the truth. Like the truth is that I am God and you know, I have created these things and things that I've created are good. I want you to enjoy them knowing that I am the God who created them. And as you enjoy them and as you use them, that you are sort of aware of that, which means, of course, I want you to use them wisely. I want you to use them as a gift from me. I want you to not abuse them, you know, and be owned by them or consumed by them. So anyway, it just reminded me of those sections and also made me feel like, you know, often we see Paul as pretty morally serious. You know, like you said, he often lists a bunch of sins in a row or a bunch of types of sinners, which makes him seem pretty morally rigorous and unyielding. And this section, not that he's unserious, not that he's sort of quote unquote going light.
A libertine or something like that.
Yeah, it's just a different sounding voice. It's a different sounding emphasis. It's like he's like creating tiers of ethics almost, that it's like, I guess your dedication to God comes primary to all the things you do for him. You know,
I think that you've kind of hit on a tension that can be pretty confusing as people read Paul, is that sometimes Paul seems really morally serious. So like, you know, here are some things that are really detrimental to your faith, really detrimental to how you live in the world. Oh, and by the way, God created everything and it's all good and enjoy it.
Yeah.
Right. So like, I could imagine that being really confusing to a student surrounding like marriage, sexuality, food, even alcohol in this passage. Like, there's a couple places where he's like, you know, if you're a leader, you need to like not be out getting drunk. But then later he's like, hey, Timothy, your stomach's upset. Not just water. Like, go ahead and hit the wine a little bit. Yeah, and so the question is, who is this guy? Mm-hmm. Who is Paul? Like, is he a libertine or is he a legalist? Right. Mm-hmm. Like, and the answer is like neither. And that's because, you know, real like Christian ethics has to hold in tension these realities of Genesis 1 and Genesis 3, mm-hmm. that God did create everything. Everything created is good, yet we're kind of broken. And so we have a tendency to take good things and twist them and turn them into things that are bad for us and oppressive to other people. And so you just have to live in both of those realities. Right. And so that's why C.S. Lewis talks about sin, he says, you know, sin isn't like bad things. Like, sin is actually the perversion of a good thing. That almost anything that we call sin, it takes something that God meant for good and uses it in a way that it wasn't meant to be used. And so what Paul's saying is that, you know, the answer here isn't to not get married. Like, the answer here isn't to like eschew all love and sexuality.
Right.
The answer is to, you know, accept it as something beautiful and good that God's made, but then, you know, to rediscover the parameters in which God made, you know, love and food and even like alcohol for our good and not for our destruction or the impression of others.
Right, right, right. And I think, okay, if we press this a little bit and we put it hyper into this context. So, you know, I've had conversations with students over the years, I've been doing this long enough, and alcohol is a big enough deal in college cultures, right, that it's come up,
right.
You know, and you know, I've heard people say that I feel so close to my friends when we're drunk and God wants me to be close to my friends. So this must be good, you know, and you can sort of see the logic of like, oh, I'm being thankful to God so I can just enjoy this how I want to enjoy it. And I guess I think, okay, well, you are being thankful to an idea of God that you might have. But if you read the texts and really know this God, he does not want you to be owned by this thing. Right. And he does not want you to abuse it. Mm-hmm. And it's definitely a good thing. If you read the scriptures, you know that alcohol is a good thing that's been created by God. It's present in Jesus's life. It's present in the festivals. You know, it's meant for the enjoyment of people. And if it's being done with the thankfulness of God, I don't think it will be abused, you know, if it's really done that way.
Yeah.
And I guess you think of like, if you have a gift from someone and they sort of give you instructions for how to use the gift and you just don't do it, you know, then you're not really respecting the giver, I guess.
Yeah, I remember when I was a kid, my godfather, just a wonderful man, but also made a lot more money than our family. Every birthday, I would get a gift from him that was just a little bit nicer than any other gift we got. And one year he bought me a glider that, you know, had a rope and you could run with it and it would take off. And it was just amazing. And we used it like that for a while. But then, you know, later we used the rope to create a trap and a maze in the living room. And we ran this rope all over the living room, just really destroyed the glider. And my dad walked in the room and the person who had given me the gift was coming over to visit later that day. And my dad got really upset and he's like, you've got to take this rope down. You've got to clean this up because he gave you this really nice gift and you're not using it the way it was meant to be used. And he had the sense that this would make the gift giver sad, that had given us this wonderful gift and we're using it in this way that was not intended for it and was ruining the gift. And I think that that's the gist of what you're saying and what Paul's saying here is that if you're really using the gift in a thankful way, you're using it in the way it's intended.
Yeah. Yeah. It reminds me too of, you know, when you go to a steakhouse, like a fancy steakhouse and like the chef has a way of wanting to prepare that steak.
That's right.
And you could go and order it and they say, how do you want your steak prepared? And if you say, well done, there are certain places that say, no, we will not do that. You know, that is not the way
it's supposed to be eaten, right?
Or if you go and you ask for like ketchup for your steak,
that's right.
They might be offended because it's like, no, I prepared a good steak for you.
Right.
It does not need ketchup. It will not taste better. Well done.
I was that waiter. I was a waiter for a while. And the best thing at our place is you could get this prime rib. And so people would order the prime rib and then they would ask for steak sauce. And I would just look at them. I would want to say, really, really?
Right.
You do realize what I'm bringing you? And you want me to bring that too, really?
right. So I think the point we're making, I think, is that the thankfulness to God clause is not just carte blanche to say, okay, if it makes me happy, then I just sort of give thanks to God for it. It's actually connected to like, do you know what God intended
That's
for this?
Right.
Can you see the logic of the gift? Do you know the sort of the dangers, the parameters? Like, do you know how it's supposed to be used?
Yeah.
And then are you using it that way? I think the thankfulness to God is really, really important part of this idea.
And I think the idea here is that Paul doesn't necessarily want us to move away from the body or like, you know, bodily joys, which is, I think, what a lot of these like rotten teachings that you're talking about, a lot of these are Gnostic, and they're basically saying the body is bad, the spirit is good, reject all the things of the body and move completely to the spirit. And Paul's just saying, no, that's not what we believe. We believe in Genesis 1. We believe that everything God made was good. We just also believe that humans have a way of twisting that. But that doesn't mean that we don't enjoy the good things that God had made. It means that we really like double down and train and fight to reclaim those good things that God has made as God has intended them.
Yeah. Cool. I like it.
Okay. So I'm going to take control of the categories back and we're going to move on to a quick question. Now, I realize that when I say that, it just sounds like I'm saying it. It's actually like an affectionate take on how I say the word question, but I'll just say it the way I say it. A quick question. Hey, Peter, did you have a quick question?
I do have a quick question. And I think that my quick question does not have a quick answer. And so I'm a little hesitant to bring it up, to be honest with you, because I don't know if I'm actually able to land anywhere. I was thinking about, it's like, hey, maybe we shouldn't talk about it. But I also want to model this a little bit. It's like, I love this part of reading the scriptures. The way that my life works is that once I come up to a question like this, it will then come up in every conversation I have with sort of the people I talk about this stuff with. I was like, what do you think about this?
Right.
And then through those conversations, going back to the text, I think you end up getting somewhere. Mm-hmm. And so this is the very, very, very beginning of that process for me. I don't know if I'm landing anywhere, but I'm still interested in the question. And so the question sort of stems from the fact that throughout this letter, and really throughout a lot of the letters we've been reading from Paul, he seems very interested in what the watching world thinks about the church.
Yeah.
And so he seems very interested in how the watching world is looking at the church. And, you know, in chapter 2, verse 1 and 2, he says, he asks for people to pray for peace and sort of to live a peaceful life, a godly and dignified life, essentially, so that the world sees us living this way. And, you know, when he talks about the deacons and the overseers in just some thrilling content, he talks about how they both must be well thought of by outsiders, that there's something about the people leading this thing must be sort of well respected by the people on the outside. And then he gets into some stuff about widows. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I guess I was a little bit surprised. You know, one of the things that's really wonderful about the faith, and, you know, we sort of tout a lot, is that, you know, the ethic of the faith is to care for the poor and the widows and the children and all that stuff. And he's certainly saying we need to care for widows and that the people in Ephesus need to care for widows. But it seems like there are these widows who are, I guess, newly widowed and so are still young and have the potential to get married again and are really not behaving well. It sounds like they're sort of sleeping around. They're kind of going from place to place, just spreading gossip, and they call them busybodies. And he's saying, hey, I don't think we should actually be associating with these people. Like, I don't think these are people we need to be aiming our care for.
Right.
I think there are some actually vulnerable women who we need to be aiming our care for, who are old, they're not going to get married. And so they need the family of God to care for them. And that makes total sense, not necessarily like sort of on a pragmatic level, but it doesn't seem like the wide open arms, like I guess I'm used to seeing. He's saying essentially like these younger widows that he's talking about who are sort of doing things poorly, he's like, they should get married, they should bear children, manage their households, and give the adversary no occasion for slander.
Mm-hmm.
So it sounds like he's saying, we don't want these people to make the outside world sort of slander us for being associated with them. And I don't know if that's exactly what he's saying, but it definitely seems like it's connected.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously there's a section that feels pretty scandalous to us. And it's in the beginning of chapter 6 when he talks about bondservants, you know, treating their masters well.
Mm-hmm.
And so he says, treat your masters well so that the name of God and the teaching may not be reviled.
Mm-hmm.
And so it seems like there's this looking outward to like, how is the world seeing us? And it sort of struck me that there's a way of talking about that that's really lovely, you know, sort of like that we are a light to the world. We're salt and light. And so we want to go bless the world. And part of that is like, bless the world. And I think a little bit so that they see us, are so compelled by the way that we live and want to see that this is the true way to live. And so it'll be sort of ushered in by the example that we've set. So it's like, yeah, of course we're going to care what they think about us because we want it to be attractive. You know, we want to compel them by the way that we live. And then there's this other side where it's sort of like image management that he's dealing with. And it's more like we don't want them to not like us. So we should behave in a certain way because we don't want them to not like us. And I've just been thinking a lot about sort of what that means and maybe what Paul would tell us. And then on the other hand, I'm thinking, hey, wait, like Paul had this experience in Ephesus that we just talked about where he was in this, the middle of a no kidding riot, mm-hmm. which seems like the watching world was not happy right. with what Paul was saying. And so I'm like, wait, what's going on? Like, if he's saying we want to live in this like peaceful life, this peaceful way, and yet he's in the center of this riot. And it seems like two different ways of approaching the watching world. You know, sometimes it's like, hey, the power structures that are existing within this society, with this culture, they cannot stand. They're not right. They're not just. So like, we are going to speak out in the middle of all these people in riot form. That's on one side. And then this other side that he's telling Timothy to say is like, hey, we need to live so that the watching world is compelled by us, is not sort of disgusted by us, and does not have any reason to not like us. You know, and I think I realize just even subjectively in my own reading is that, you know, I've talked about this before. I'm an Enneagram 9. Mm-hmm. And so I'm a peacemaker. And so this style in Timothy really makes a lot of sense to me. Right. It sort of makes sense to slowly build up credibility and sort of love your way to people's hearts, as opposed to maybe an Enneagram 8 style mm-hmm. of like, let me talk to as many people as possible and tell them the truth and sort of speak truth to power. Like, that scares me. And so I know that sort of coming to the text, like, I'm attracted to this style of dealing with the world of like, yeah, I'm hoping to like live in a way that's so compelling that people might want to join the team, right? Not like telling them that they're wrong and they can't be wrong anymore because it's so bad, you know?
Let me see if I understand what you're saying.
Yeah.
You're saying that, okay, we have this character of Paul who no one would accuse of being an Enneagram 9, right? Like, no one would right. accuse of being shy or someone who is, you know, unduly a people pleaser.
Yeah.
He starts riots. He says things like, I am not ashamed of the gospel. You know, he happily goes to jail, immediately starts talking to the jailers. He asks to be sent to Caesar himself, right, for trial. Like, this is not a coward, not a withering flower. But then he says things yeah. in 1 Timothy like, first of all, then I urge that supplication, prayer, intercession, and thanksgiving be made for all people, for kings and all who are in high positions, that we may lead peaceful and quiet lives, godly and dignified in every way. And so there's this sense in which he's like, yeah, but keep your heads down. And yeah. so the question is, well, what should we do? Should we keep our heads down? Should we go along with social conventions, even if we find them, you know, off-putting or, you know, maybe even evil? Or do we fight power? Like, do we speak up at every opportunity about the gospel? And then, you know, just think about what happened in Philippi. You know, Philippi, he wasn't there for 10 minutes before he drove a demon out of a slave girl, because of course there's a demon in a slave girl. Paul's not going to stand for mm-hmm. that. And that gets him driven out of town. Right. And so, like, will the real Paul please stand up? Is that what kind of what you're getting at?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, I don't know how much you want to venture into these waters, I guess, but I guess the cultural moment right now is specifically with like racial justice and stuff.
That's right.
And I haven't thought enough about how this connects to that. So it's like, I don't totally feel comfortable going all the way down that road, but it's like, I think right now the speak truth to power form of Paul
right.
has been brought up more, you know? And so I guess I was just surprised to read how conscious he was about appearing pleasing
yeah.
to the watching world and how that interacts with what we should do now. Should we be speaking truth to power more? Anyway, yeah, I think I am asking that question a little
yeah.
bit of like, what's real and what's real for now?
I have a couple of thoughts on that. One is that yeah. I do think that, you know, people can get into their personality type and just say, you know, that's the way I am. But that's not really what yes. personality types are about, right? Like, I'm an introvert, but that's not an excuse to be an introvert. You know, and I think a lot of people are yeah. surprised I'm an introvert because I've worked really, really hard for 2 decades to develop some extroverted coping mechanisms, right? And because
yeah.
I don't think that it's okay to just be an introvert and not be around people. You know, I think there's some real strengths that come from my introversion. But there's some real weaknesses mm-hmm. as well that I need to go to work on. And I just think that Paul is a whole person. I think that Paul recognizes that there's a little bit of a George Martin, you know, George Martin, his whole canon comes from the question after the Lord of the Rings of what was Aragorn's tax policy, right? And so you have this great story of the Lord of the Rings of Aragorn becoming the king. And then like, yeah, but like, how did he deal with widows, right? And so there's this sense in which Paul like totally...
Sorry,
this
awesome.
May be cut.
No, I think I see what you're saying about Aragorn's tax policy, where it's like the story can be so compelling of like how we got to the fact that the church now is the church,
right.
you know, and it's this multi-ethnic, multicultural phenomenon that is the hope of the world, you know, but it's like, but that hope of the world still needs to live in a messy world,
that's right.
You know, and navigate through it.
And make careful, wise decisions about
yeah.
different cultural phenomena that arise that put individuals in tough situations and that you just, yeah. you need to be wise about. But then I think the actual thing you're getting at is like, is a Christian an Enneagram 8 or an Enneagram 9?
Yeah.
Whatever the Enneagram number is for people who don't know their Enneagram number, that's me. But
that's you.
The answer is no. Right. Like, and Paul has grown outside of his personality type to realize there are mm-hmm. times for confrontation and there are times mm-hmm. for non-confrontation. And I think what really underlines all of this is that, you know, when was the book of First Timothy read?
I think it's estimated like 62 to 66 AD.
Okay. And so what's happening in 62 or 66? Well, in 64, Rome burns. Nero's reign goes through 68. And so we're dealing with the end of Nero's reign and particularly the burning of Rome, which is like the most dangerous time to be a Christian. And so you can see in chapter 2, and he says, you know, also pray for the kings so that we may live peaceable and quiet lives. He's not talking about so that we can knit doilies and not have to deal with, you know, marginal tax rates of 28%, right? He's talking about so that they won't kill us. And, you know, what's yeah. going on at this time is that, you know, there's rumors that the reason that Rome burned was because Christianity is growing. People don't really understand what the Lord's Supper is. And so they actually think that Christians are cannibals that eat babies.
Yeah. This is such an interesting detail of right, any right. church history.
This is
yeah.
the rumor that's being spread about the church. And what Paul is saying is there's enough fiction out there about us. People are saying enough bad things about us that aren't true. Let's not give them bad things that are true to say about us.
Yeah.
Because people will always make up things about the church that aren't true. It's just better if they don't have things that are true about us to say. And so there is a sense in which image management is important to Paul. And I think mm-hmm. image management is important to Paul because people are like legitimately dying.
Yeah, that's actually really helpful. And, you know, I was sort of wondering about this question of like, how can this person who's in this riot, you know, and gets kicked out of town and almost dies, mm-hmm. you know, in this riot, how can he tell us to like sort of be cool,
yeah.
you know, be patient? And, you know, I went back and read the story in Acts 19, and I'd always thought that Paul started the riot mm-hmm. and he didn't.
Right.
Like the riot started, the riot formed, and by a lot of the stuff he was saying and the inroads that quote unquote the way was making, which is so cool in Acts,
yeah,
it says the way.
That's right.
But the riot formed and then Paul stepped up mm-hmm. in the riot and spoke to it,
yeah.
which is a different thing, I feel like, than being the one to incite it. And he was there for 3.5 years. So if Christians should always and everywhere be sort of confrontational mm-hmm. to everything that is against our story and particularly everything that's sort of built into the culture around us that is against our story or that is an incomplete part of our story, then Paul wasn't doing that for 3.5 years. Like, was he being unfaithful for those 3.5 years as he was building friendships, as he was building relationships, as he was slowly growing this movement? Was he being unfaithful until he got to the big point where he made the big declaration? Or was all that important? Was the way that Christianity relates to the watching world a really delicate dance of like, sometimes you're going to have to say a hard thing, but a lot of times you're going to have to slowly build. You're going to have to like start with you.
That's right.
And then your household is going to live a little bit differently than the normal Roman household. And hopefully that creates a church that lives differently than the normal group of people in this community. And, you know, it's interesting because, again, in that story in Ephesus with this riot, he would have died, but he was saved by, they call them the Asiarchs.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's how to pronounce it, but like, these are people who are leaders in this city, the city that he is saying their economy is sort of bankrupt, essentially, morally and spiritually and existentially bankrupt. These are friends he has made who are rulers of that city who save him from the riot. So you can think somewhere in those 3.5 years, he actually made friends with the people who are in power.
Right.
And if it wasn't for them, he would have died. And he gets expelled from Ephesus after this. So it's like, it feels to me like there's sometimes when if you're going to follow Jesus, you might have to say something very hard and you might have to say it strongly. And probably that will be in an area where you have relationships. Mm-hmm. That won't be you go into town and just say it. It probably will be with people who you've built relationships with. You actually really know the ins and outs of what they believe and what they think, which might make what you say sting all the more. But it's not just going to be, you're not a vigilante.
Right.
You know, you're not going in from place to place and just screaming at people. Mm-hmm. And that's what the dance is, I think, a little bit, where it's not a science, it's an art of both like living in such a way that the gospel is compelling, that people want to be a part of it, but also it's absolutely going to butt heads with the current belief structures of whatever culture it happens to be nestled in. And so how it butts those heads, I think, is not the same way every time. And I feel very grateful that there are Enneagram 8 Christians, and I hope that they're in the churches around me and they're in conversations with me, because they're probably going to move me to say something that I would have been maybe too scared to say. But I do think people like me who are just more attracted to a slow build of change, I think we're needed too.
Right.
And I do think that if the reason to not say something is particularly because you're scared, I don't think that's
what
Paul's talking about.
That's right.
I think that Paul's saying, like, no, this is not a tactic of fear. This is a tactic of wisdom.
That's right.
Like, the best way for the gospel to advance right now is for us to slowly, like, transform these sort of structures at the bottom of the pyramid,
right.
You know, and then hopefully we move up.
That's right.
And there's going to be some times when we shout to the top of the pyramid, but that's not every time. That's not every day.
And I think that, so we're talking kind of about this on the individual level,
yeah.
But like on the institution level, the question is the church a stabilizing or destabilizing institution? And I think that we're in a moment where institutions are not getting a lot of good press.
Yeah.
And so the only good institutions are destabilizing institutions. I would consider the university particularly a destabilizing institution, and it's getting a lot of praise for that. And the answer is, well, both. The church is a stabilizing and a destabilizing institution, right? The church destabilizes injustice, but stabilizes society. Mm. And so there is this sense in which you see Paul both destabilizing the injustices that come from like particular economic systems or, you know, particular Roman policies, but is also trying to build the good on the neighborhood scale, on the city scale,
yeah.
And through the particular institution of the church, which is, you know, Timothy's one of the first places where he makes a statement of, you know, what the church is and why the church isn't just like a conglomeration of loosely affiliated Christians, but actually like a family that tries to do life together.
Yeah, yeah. First of all, that was not a quick question. That was
a quick question.
But I'm glad we talked about it. I feel like we did what I said that I do. You know, I have a question and then we sort of work it out. And so not that we've worked it out, but we're closer than when we started.
And I think that that's important for people to understand is that if you read something in the scriptures and it just strikes you as weird, that's okay. You know, a lot of the quick questions I've had have been slowly answered over decades, honestly.
Yeah.
And, you know, at some point you get enough questions answered that you realize questions get answered. You know, early on, there can just be a lot of them and it can seem daunting and can seem scary until you start to see that, oh, you know, there is trajectory towards all of these. Okay, but let's move beyond a quick question or even excuse me what. There is a category that you proposed at the very beginning, and that's the category, can I have an eraser? And just to be clear, we don't think that the text should be edited. We don't think we have the authority to edit the text, but sometimes we sure would like to, wouldn't we?
Yeah.
Sometimes we're reading these passages and we're just like, oh, I wish that didn't say that.
Right.
So Peter, you have a can I have an eraser in this passage?
I do. There's a section in this letter to Timothy, where Paul first addresses men in the church and essentially says that they should pray and that they shouldn't be angry or quarrelsome. And then he talks about women. And this is a section where if I'm not, don't have an eraser, I'd sure like to turn on track changes or something like that edit it back and say, hey, Paul, I wonder if you could say this a little differently.
Yeah, right.
So, you know, I was getting prepared to sort of talk about this. And then I realized that, you know, our plans for next quarter are to sort of do what we did with the Old Testament, that we kind of went through the story of the Old Testament in the winter. And then the quarter after, we were going to talk about the themes of the Old Testament, the thing, like the major themes that get explored. And so sort of what we want to do for next quarter is that we want to go through every letter this quarter. And then next quarter, we want to sort of tease out what are like some of the themes once we've seen a large swath of the texts, what are some of the themes.
Including some of the difficult themes, some of the things that come up that just don't make a lot of sense to us as, you know, contemporary people.
Right, right. But maybe aren't the things to always be talking about when you're trying to just talk about a particular letter.
That's right.
Because it takes trying to take more into account. Let's build more of a theology around this, not just what is Paul saying just to Timothy in this one section. So all that to say, we hope to talk about this next quarter and talk about particularly sort of women in the church, how Paul sees women. There's sort of two ways, sort of in the household as, you know, wives, and then also in the church. Mm-hmm. And I think this has been a major sticking
point,
and a major process of conversation and controversy in people who think about the texts and people who are trying to lead churches. And, you know, it can be the first adjective that people use about a church. Oh, that's a traditionalist church, or that's an egalitarian church. You know, traditional church is one that reads this passage pretty literally, that women should not be above men in teaching and that men should be the ones doing the teaching. And so that means that men should be the pastors, should be the elders and all that stuff. And then there's the egalitarian churches that see some nuances in this and think that actually, I don't think that Paul's speaking at that as strongly as that. And so I think there's room. Mm-hmm. Clearly, women have gifts in teaching. Hello, Bronwyn Lee, you know. So clearly women have gifts in teaching. And so we're going to have them on our team of teachers and on our board, whatever. So it's a big deal. And, you know, I have had lots of thoughts on this over the years. It was actually, I remember in my ethics class, in Christian ethics class in seminary, this was the topic I chose to write my paper on. I've just been sort of fascinated by this. So in doing what we're doing right now, it's not because I don't know what I think or don't have what I sort of think could be a fair reading of this text. But I was just thinking, you know, I think I want to save this conversation for when we do it in the winter. Mm-hmm. And I think the main reason is that I sort of have my own theological understanding of this.
As do I, and we're on the same page.
Yeah. But I've never had to emotionally reckon with it the way a woman in my position might have. Mm-hmm. And so I think when we have the conversation, I want to have the conversation. Mm-hmm. Like right now, there's no woman talking call right now. Right. And so there's no one who has had to reckon with that reality. Mm-hmm. And deal with the emotional side of this in the way that I...
And the stakes, the word that we used is stakes. You know, when men talk stakes. About this, we don't have skin in the game. It's like an intellectual conversation.
Right.
But like that's not how this conversation is experienced. So we want to have this conversation with folks who have experienced the stakes of this conversation.
Right. And so what I want to do is I just want to flag it. Like I see it there. If you're reading Timothy, I know you see it there.
We're not ignoring it.
Yeah, we want to have a conversation. And I'll just say for now that whatever you think about this passage, it has to square with what else we see in the New Testament. And it has to square with the fact that there are women who are learning, who are sitting at the feet of Jesus learning, and who are really, you know, robust leaders in the early church, you know, and like, for example, like Romans was most likely given to Phoebe to take the letter to the Romans, which is one of the most magnificent pieces of literature ever, you know, certainly one of like Paul's maybe magnum opus, right? Like taken in the hands of Phoebe, and she probably read it to the Romans. And that's some conjecture, but I mean, anyway, so we're getting into it right now, but it has to square with the fact that women were doing robust leading and teaching and becoming disciples of Jesus.
That's right. Okay, so we'll look forward to having a conversation on that in the winter. Okay, the last category we wanted to talk about was, excuse me, what?
Excuse me, what?
Yeah. What was the thing that made you say, excuse me, what?
Well, you know, I think potentially a underlying sort of idea in college life teaching is, you know, we're pretty formational our teaching. We have a pretty fundamental understanding that it is not just our intuition that should be guiding what we think about the world, but we want the scriptures and the Holy Spirit to form us to see sort of the world in light of true reality, or so to speak. So it's like left to our own devices, we are sort of still these broken things, and that we hope to create complete and equipped agents of King Jesus. And that implies that there's some formation that's going to have to happen. And so it was so interesting to me and a little off-putting, and it made me say, excuse me, what? When I kept reading Paul use the word conscience in this text, and he uses it sort of a bunch of times. And four times. And the first time he says, you know, when he's talking about the difference between good teaching and bad teaching, whatever, he says that the aim of essentially good teaching is love that issues from a pure heart and a good conscience and sincere faith. And he keeps continuing to talk about a good conscience. And he talks about those who are sort of teaching poorly, they have a seared conscience.
Yeah.
The excuse me what is just them like, this sounds like Paul saying, just follow your heart. Mm. Like he's essentially saying like, you know what's right. Mm-hmm. Just follow your conscience, which mm-hmm. I feel like that's, to me, that's my read of like what culture says.
That's
our modern culture is just like, follow your heart. You know what's right. Follow your intuitions. And so it just sort of made me say like, excuse me, what? Like I thought we were distinct from that. I thought we were trying to say something else. I thought we were saying that our hope and our aim is for us to be formed to sort of see the right way. Our conscience doesn't tell us that.
Right.
But it's the formation done by the Spirit.
Yeah. So I think that obviously Paul thinks that the conscience is something that's pretty important. But I'm not sure that we really understand what conscience is.
That's my question. It's like, what is conscience?
Yeah. Because I think that the way that you're describing conscience and this kind of follow your heart, and I think that the way that people use the term conscience is intuition. Right. Like I have an intuition of what's right. Follow your gut.
Yeah.
And the problem is that intuition is usually terrible. The whole idea behind Blink, you know, the Gladwell book that came out is that, you know, some people have great intuition. You know, the whole idea behind that is that people who have really good intuitions are people who have trained their intuition with 10,000 hours.
Yeah.
The thesis of that book isn't that, hey, just follow your intuition. It's like, no, train your intuition with like years and years of practice, and then it'll be good. Right. And so I think that that's more along the lines of what Paul is talking about here. I think, first of all, that, you know, that we do tend to have a general moral sense that if we suppress our moral sense, the moral sense is suppressible and it can go away. That's the whole idea behind the seared conscience. I mean, throughout the book of 1 Timothy, he talks about practice and training, you know, the kinds of formational words that we use.
Yeah.
And so I think that there's this sense of which if you are a person of spiritual training, if you do train yourself in the things of God, then your conscience becomes the sort of thing that has the sorts of intuitions that you want to follow. But then there are other times when you just really know the right thing to do and don't want to do it. In those cases, what he's saying is, well, then you need to do it.
Yeah. So are you essentially saying that, say, a college student goes through our program or whatever, becomes complete and equipped, however that is defined? Then Paul might say to that person, yeah, you have trained your conscience. From now on, continue this way, you know, dedicated to Jesus. You know, from now on, it's like, you should trust your conscience. You know, it's been trained. It's been calibrated.
Yeah, I mean, but I think there are times when I distrust my conscience, right? Like, I think that there are times when my incentives are so misaligned that I don't really trust my intuition or my conscience. And I think that's part of you know, the question of how do you know things? Like, epistemology is really a fundamental question of reality, is like, how do you actually know things are true, especially when you have incentives to want to believe something's true? Mm-hmm. There's one like theological tradition that talks about the Wesleyan quadrilateral. This is something that John Wesley came up with to talk about, like, how do you know things are true? It's a multidimensional epistemology where it says, you know, truth emerges from like the direct revelation of scripture, but then also reason and tradition and experience. And it's interesting, in Timothy, like, Paul actually talks about all of those things. Like, in 2 Timothy, he talks about scripture. In 1 Timothy, he talks about the church and about how the church is the pillar of the truth and how, like, things that the church passes on, you can have confidence. That's one of the reasons I talked about the Chalcedonian Creed the other day, is because the Chalcedonian Creed is something the church has always and everywhere believed. So it's not something that I really, like, spend a lot of time, like, investigating the truth claims of it. And so, you know, you've got scripture, you've got tradition, you've got reason, and then you've got experience. And those are the things that you use to train your conscience so that, you know, when you are making intuitional decisions, you have a higher probability of kind of getting that right if they've been trained in that quadrilateral.
Yeah, it's interesting about that quadrilateral because obviously experience and reason feel like the shaky legs on that table if you're wanting just pure doctrinal, you know.
It's not a square. It's a quadrilateral, right? They're not equal. They're not equal parts. But they are all parts.
But like the power of experiencing something you think is true as true is like as tantalizing as it gets. Like that's when it feels like I've really adopted it and it's like into me now.
Right.
I've experienced it as true, you know, which I think is why I keep talking about the Lord's Prayer.
Right.
Because I think that I've learned a lot about God's love for me as a father in my time. And I've learned a lot about, that God's supposed to like be powerful and stuff. But it's only recently that I feel like I've practiced my way into like actually trying to interact with those ideas and like on a sort of trust on a daily level, trying to put myself in the presence of God to pray for those things. And I feel like I've experienced it, which just means those ideas are truer to me, you know?
That's right. It's like you've been to lab class, right? Like science majors like to say that lab is the biggest credit ripoff in the university, right? Because you spend, you know, every bit the same amount of time on lab as you do on lecture, but you only get one credit for it. But you get lots of wisdom for it. So just hang in there, science majors. It's worth it.
Right.
What lab does is it takes these like ethereal ideas and makes them tangible.
Yeah.
That's what experience does, is that if you are, you know, committed to the scriptures and the tradition of the church, then, you know, reason isn't the only thing that turns that into practical knowledge, but like actually experiencing the truth of that is the thing that starts to build your conscience.
Yeah. So, okay. So then my excuse me what of like, this sounds like it's just like follow your heart. It's more like follow your conscience when it's been like trained, when you've let it be sort of transformed by the Holy Spirit.
I think that it is connected with what he says in 5:7, where he says, you know, train yourself for godliness.
Yeah.
There's a program of training that helps develop your intuition so that you can start to trust your conscience more.
Yeah. Okay. Interesting. Yeah. So it sort of feels like that's what we want to say probably to students.
I think so too. Like, I do not trust my intuition.
Yeah.
I am constantly questioning my intuition. Intuition is almost always self-interested, but I do try to feed the voice of my conscience, usually telling me that something I want in the moment is not good for me or others, or, you know, a rebellion against God. I try to feed that voice, which is not always the loudest voice. And I think that's part of what's going on here.
Yeah. And I think that, like, just to maybe wrap my mind around it again, it's like, I think that I assume that your conscience is that which you are sort of mainly directed at. Like, your conscience is sort of a default thinking that you do. And it's aimed probably, you know, if we go back to the James Smith stuff that I always talk about, but it's like, it's aimed at that which you love the most and worship, essentially. And so it's going to align with your deepest values.
Yeah.
Potentially. And so what you need to do, if you sense that your conscience is taking you away from the sort of center of the faith, is that you might just think, oh, I might need God to change my conscience for that which seems right to me to be that which seems right to God.
That's right. And I think that that's where the whole idea of searing the conscience comes, is that, you know, in chapter 4, he talks about how there is a group of people, these people who are manipulating the church for personal gain, who they might not even feel like they're doing the wrong thing because they have kind of subsumed their moral compass to self-interest so many times that they've confused them. And so now they can't distinguish between, you know, what's truly right in the world and what they want to be right.
Yeah. Interesting. Good stuff.
Okay. So I think that will bring us to everyone's favorite moment, where a couple of boring dads tell them what we've been doing in the quarantine to be interesting.
Right.
And this is Quarantine Corner, which I listen to and I enjoy.
Yeah.
Why don't I start?
Yeah.
Mine have been pretty light, but I have one that I've really been enjoying. And so I really believe in multi-sensory experience of the scriptures. I transcribe the scripture, I color, I draw, like, I speak it out loud. Just any way that you can experience the scriptures in multiple senses, I try to do, which means that, you know, for a while, like, I have had a practice of listening to the scriptures. And this is easier with narrative than the Pauline letters. I tend to tune Paul out if I'm listening to the scriptures. But there is a new, a relatively new audio Bible called The Bible Experience. And what the Bible Experience did is they went out and they hired all of the, like, top Black actors to basically produce and perform the scriptures. And so I got this when we did Exodus, because the performance of Exodus is unbelievably compelling.
Who performed the Exodus one?
Oh, just a bunch. Exodus is a cast. And so, like, anything that's a narrative, they have multiple roles that go back and forth, right? It's actually a produced cast, which is just, you know, unbelievably compelling. But because we're reading through the letters, I was like, all right, how interesting could this be? Because there's going to be a person cast as Paul, and he's going to read all of them. And he does a great job. But the thing they do during the letters is they kind of, I think they recognize that the audio experience of the letters is maybe not the way that they were meant to be experienced. And so they'll throw in an intermission from a gospel choir in the middle of the letter. It is just the absolute most fun way to experience the audio text that I've encountered. It's a little bit pricey, but if you have an Audible account, you can get it for one credit. But that's my, I'm going to swing spiritual this week and say, if you're interested in, you know, experiencing the scriptures with an audio practice, the Bible Experience, I think, is the best audio text out there.
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
I like that. You said that you're going to swing spiritual, and I'm going to swing literal.
Okay.
This weekend, which was, I'm not even going to try to explain it, but I went golfing with my dad and my brother for my dad's birthday over the weekend that just happened, which is somewhere in your past as you're listening to this. And I think I realized something about golf. I think I've come to some conclusion about golf, which might be a scandalous take on life, but I think that there's only two reasonable paths for golf.
Okay.
One is to be really good.
Yes.
And what I describe as really good is that you know where the ball is going to go before you step up to swing, and you have a reasonable expectation that it's going to go where it's going to go.
Okay. That sounds really like good when it comes to golf.
Yeah.
So it's either you're really good at golf, which would just be a delight. Mm-hmm. I mean, even if you don't like golf, like the feeling of when you hit a good shot, and if you could do that a lot, mm-hmm. that would be great. Or you just need to be good enough that you have a few shots of those a round.
Yes.
So not even one a hole. A few around.
Enough to remember. You go home and you think, oh, those three shots were really lovely.
Yeah.
I experienced something borderline transcendent those three times, even though I shot like 25 over par. I'm just using golf words. I don't play golf.
Yeah. Okay. So here's the problem. I feel like most golfers are somewhere in between that.
Yeah.
And they're either like they're worse than that, which is like we're not even talking about you. You probably don't want to play golf anymore. Or they're somewhere in between. And that somewhere in between is, I think, the worst possible place to be. Because you're better than like one shot that's great every few holes. So you feel like you should be the person that can do it right every time. But you're not there. And so the frustration that you have all the time is untenable. Mm-hmm. Like the majority of people experiencing golf, I think, are frustrated. Mm-hmm. There's either the people who are so good that are just like living in sublimity, or there's the people who are like me. I think I've realized that I'm in the perfect spot because I'm not expecting to be great.
Yes.
So I'm surprising myself often.
Yeah.
But when I am sort of expecting that, like, I should be better than this, then I'm just living in frustration all the time. And bless my dad's soul. So he worked very, very hard. And so he is now not working anymore. And so he's putting a lot of time and energy and probably money into his golf game. And so he's better than he's ever been, in my opinion. And he's better than me, obviously. But he seems still so frustrated that he's not making the shots that he thinks he should be making. And I just realized when we were golfing, like, my experience seems like it's better than his. You know, I'm worse. He's hitting a few better shots than mine, but I'm in like the sweet spot of the expectation and the reality are like are aligned properly, you know? And then I realized like, well, you should be good at golf because, you know, if you're in the business world, it's a way to, you know, attract clients or make deals. And then I realized, well, if you're like me, then your boss or the person you're trying to sell on the thing is going to beat you, which is a good thing for them to feel like they had a good day. Don't you think?
I could see that.
Doesn't behoove me to be better than the person, my boss, you know, or be better than the person I'm trying to beat. But I should probably impress them a few times so they know that I'm not a chump, you know?
Right, right.
So in this golfing experience, I shot a 115. Okay, that's not good, right?
All right.
But I had two pars in a row.
Ooh.
And my last shot of the day was a chip in. I didn't even putt on the last green.
Nice.
So I was like, I'm going home feeling pretty good about that, you know? And so I think I realized that you should either be below mediocre or be really good. So it's almost like shooting the moon in hearts.
Yes.
It's like, if you want to shoot the moon and try to be really good, you're going to have to deal with a lot of times when you get caught with the queen of spades,
you know,
where you are mad at the game. You're mad at the world. So anyway, I realized that about golf. So I think you should play golf. Because golf is fun and a lot of time to talk and it's good to be outdoors. But that's my hot take.
All right. That is a pretty hot take. Yeah.
So anyway, that is it for the podcast. Thanks, Stanford, for taking the reins this morning. And we'll see you for our last one. Christian Wingate, 1 Peter. All right. That is it for Timothy. I want to say thank you to Stanford for fearlessly and faithfully guiding us through that conversation. You know, I always tell Katie that I think that my skills come more from noticing interesting things about the text and not necessarily coming to firm conclusions. So I hope that the wondering aloud of this episode felt satisfying to listen to because it sure was satisfying to talk about. Kyle Jung, Josh Paskey, thank you for your award-winning music for your pod and your staff. If you haven't won an award yet, you will soon. And Heidi Grudvogts, thank you so much for your editing prowess. You know, we are on to our last episode of the quarter. 1 Peter is the letter we'll be talking about next week with a recent married guy, current seminarian, and consistent friend of the ministry, Christian Wingate. But to close this week, College Life, you should know that we love you. And if our love for you was a golf score, it would be much lower than 115, which is a good thing. We'll see you next week.